So imagine a towering, completely silent European cathedral.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
Right. It has these massive pointed neo-Gothic spires, and they're reaching way up into the sky, seemingly searching for this pure celestial silence.
Very solemn.
Very traditional.
Exactly. Now, completely surround the base of that solemn monument with like a massive fleet of roaring, mud-caked military
Oh,
jeeps.
wow. That is quite the visual shift.
Right. You have traders shouting over the engine noise. You've got mules carrying immense sacks of coffee dirt, dust, and just sheer unfiltered chaos.
I mean, honestly, it sounds like a total desecration of a sacred space. Just a complete clash of two entirely different
It
worlds.
really does. It sounds like somebody accidentally built a church in the middle of, well, an industrial loading dock.
Yeah, pretty much.
But the crazy thing is, in one very specific town in the Colombian Andes, this chaotic clash isn't a contradiction at all. It is literally the exact blueprint for a community's entire historical identity.
Which, you know, is a massive paradigm shift in how we usually think about historical spaces. And that is exactly our mission for this deep dive. We are going to completely shatter that sanitized velvet rope illusion we all seem to have about historic
We
monuments.
really do. We tend to view these buildings as existing under glass, completely isolated from the sweat, the noise of daily life.
Right. But today, we are exploring how religious architecture actually shapes and is intimately shaped by the true grit of community identity.
And we have some incredibly unique source material guiding this exploration today.
We really do.
We are looking at a specific watercolor painting alongside the artist's personal, highly technical notes. So the piece is titled Six Basilica Sevilla, and it was created by the artist J.O. Duque.
And it depicts the Basilica de San Luis Gonzaga, right? Which is in the municipality of Sevilla, sitting in the Valle del Cauca Department of Colombia.
Exactly. But the geographic journey of the artwork itself is, well, it's a whole story on its own.
Oh, totally. Because Du painted this deeply, unmistakably Colombian scene thousands of miles away. He was in Whittier, California in October of 2022.
Right. And then the piece eventually made its way to an exhibition in Alma, Spain in early 2024.
So it's been around the world.
It has. And that physical distance between the artist and his subject is, it's the crucial starting point here.
How so?
Because Duke was sitting in a studio in California. He didn't have the physical building right in front of him to just copy, brick by meticulous brick.
He had to rely on memory.
Exactly. He was forced to rely entirely on his memory. He had to filter out the noise and distill the absolute true atmosphere of the town.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because to understand how a community's identity blends with its architecture in the real world, we first need to look at how this artist physically blended those concepts on the canvas.
We have to talk about the materiality of the artwork because, artists never choose their mediums by accident.
Right, the medium is the message, as they say.
Precisely. The physical material actively dictates how you perceive the final message. And Duke's technical notes are fascinatingly specific.
Yeah, he didn't just grab like a random sketchbook off a shelf.
No, not at all. He specifically used a 300-gram cold-pressed Arches paper, measuring exactly 15 by 11 inches.
And he also notes using Daniel Smith pigments. Now, to anyone who isn't deep into fine arts, arguing over paperweight or naming a specific brand of paint probably sounds like reading a stationery catalog.
It does sound a bit dry if you don't know the context.
But the physics of these choices change everything about the painting. I mean, a 300-gram paper is incredibly thick. It feels almost like rigid cardstock.
Oh, absolutely. And it's engineered for one specific purpose.
Handling massive amounts of water, of course.
Yes, handling huge, heavy washes of water without warping or, turning into a soggy mess.
Right, because water is the whole vehicle in watercolor.
Exactly. And what's fascinating here is how that thick paper interacts with those specific Daniel Smith pigments.
Because they're known for something really specific, aren't they?
Yeah, they are famous in the art world for something called granulation. They are made from actual crushed minerals.
Okay, crushed minerals.
Right. So when you flood that thick paper with water, the heavy mineral particles literally fall out of suspension. They just sink.
Wait, isn't architectural watercolor usually about precise, rigid drafting? This sounds intentionally messy.
It is.
I mean, you picture an architect capturing the exact mathematical angle of a flying buttress with a tiny, fine-tipped brush. Flooding heavy minerals with water just sounds, I don't know, chaotic.
Well, the messiness is the entire point.
Yeah.
And it's heavily tied to the fact that the paper is cold pressed.
What does the cold pressing actually do?
When paper is cold pressed during the manufacturing process, it retains this highly rugged, coarse texture. Like if you were to put a magnifying glass to this 15 by 11 inch sheet, you wouldn't see a flat surface at all.
No.
No, you would see this vast microscopic landscape of tiny mountains and valleys.
Oh, I see. So when Duke applies these fluid washes of watercolor, the heavy granulating minerals are literally cascading down into those microscopic valleys and getting trapped there.
Precisely. The liquid pools, the colors bleed, they run, they mix in entirely unpredictable ways.
That's incredible.
Yeah. He notes using broad fluid washes for the sky to convey a sense of spiritual vastness. You know, the transcendent silence the basilica's spires are reaching for.
Right.
But at the street level, the physics of the paper and the granulating pigment actively prevent him from painting hard, perfect lines.
I mean, if you've ever accidentally spilled a glass of water on a thick piece of textured cardboard and watched the ink run, you know exactly what this looks like.
Exactly.
And that is actually a brilliant analogy for the town itself. The microscopic valleys of the cold-pressed paper trap the pigment, exactly the way the physical streets of the plaza trap the messy, chaotic, daily history of its people.
I love that analogy. It's spot on. The edges of the basilica in the painting actually diffuse and bleed outward into the colorful, faceless crowd below.
Because the paper forces it to.
Yes. Duke doesn't paint distinct faces or perfectly drafted car headlights. It is all washes of color blending together.
So the architecture isn't isolated from the people at all.
Not even a little bit. It's portrayed as a living, breathing organism growing directly out of the chaotic street.
Which perfectly mirrors a massive physical adaptation that happened on the ground in Sevilla. The blurring of lines on this 15 by 11 inch canvas reflects a real life shift in how this local Colombian community interacted with a traditionally rigid European architectural style.
We are talking about the neo-Gothic style, of course,
mm-hmm.
which comes with very strict, deeply ingrained psychological rules.
Oh, absolutely. When we look at traditional European neo-Gothic cathedrals, think of the famous ones in France or Germany, they are structures fundamentally designed to intimidate.
That's their whole purpose.
They rely on extreme vertical lines, pointed arches that aggressively draw your eye up toward the heavens. It's an architecture built entirely on power dynamics.
Yeah, it's meant to demand absolute reverence, to make the human observer feel incredibly fragile, earthly, and, well, insignificant before the divine.
It creates a strict hierarchy. You have these cold, oppressive stone grays looking down on you, enforcing a profound sense of solemnity and silence.
So quiet.
So what does this all mean for the locals? If the original architectural blueprint is essentially meant to scream, look up and be quiet, how on earth does that mesh with a loud, bustling Colombian market right on its doorstep?
Well, the rigid European style had to be domesticated.
Domesticated?
Yeah, it was fundamentally reshaped by the tropics and by local social necessity. You see this vividly in Duke's color palette in the watercolor.
Oh, because of the colors he chose.
Exactly. He entirely ditches those cold, oppressive stone grays you would expect from a traditional Gothic cathedral. He bathes the entire facade of the basilica in warm, vibrant, inviting yellows.
Oh, wow. So it completely changes the emotional temperature of the building?
Completely.
It goes from being this, like, fortress that shuts the world out to a beacon that pulls the world in.
It proves that religious architecture in this specific region didn't arrive to suppress the community's daily life. It adapted to serve it. The building was integrated physically and visually into the plaza.
And the reason this architecture had to adapt, the reason had to welcome the chaos rather than put up a velvet rope to keep it out, is because the community's sheer survival depended on a very specific, incredibly muddy economic engine.
An engine that operated literally at the church doors.
Exactly. And we cannot talk about Sevilla or its architecture without talking about coffee.
You really can't. Sevilla is widely considered the coffee capital of Colombia.
Which is saying something.
Right. And today it is a central node in the coffee cultural landscape of Colombia, which is designated as a UNESCO World Heritage Site.
But to understand why the plaza looks and acts the way it does today, we have to rewind. We need to look at the historical social structure defined by the coffee trade.
We have to talk about the Antioquian colonization of the 19th and early 20th centuries.
Right. And this was not an easy process.
No, this was a grueling, brutal period of expansion. You had entire families of pioneers from the Antioquia region migrating south.
Into completely untamed territory.
Traversing the incredibly harsh, unyielding terrain of the Andes.
Mm.
They weren't just you know, walking into an open prairie.
No, picture yourself trying to clear a near-vertical mountainside using nothing but a machete just to plant coffee bushes. The geography is extreme.
So steep and so rugged.
And because of its location on a ridge, Sevilla naturally became a geographic choke point. It was the crucial connector between the sprawling Valle del Cauca and the high-altitude coffee-growing regions.
And that majestic, towering, neo-Gothic basilica we've been discussing, it didn't magically appear out of thin air.
Right, and it wasn't funded by some distant royal decree either.
No, it was paid for entirely by this local coffee money. The wealth generated by that back-breaking agricultural labor on the mountain slopes is literally what built those neo-Gothic spires.
Which introduces a massive logistical nightmare.
Oh, absolutely.
We have tons and tons of coffee grown on these steep, unpaved, rain-soaked Andean slopes. How do you physically transport a massive harvest from the side of a muddy cliff down into the center of town to trade?
Well, initially, they relied on mules and horses. But animals have severe cargo limits.
And the journey is incredibly slow.
Very slow. So as the coffee boom grew, they needed machines. But modern transport trucks were completely useless.
Yeah, you can't take an 18-wheeler up a dirt cliff.
Exactly. They were simply too big, too wide, and way too heavy to navigate the sheer drops and the deep mud of the narrow mountain passes.
Here's where it gets really interesting. After World War II, the U.S. military had a massive surplus of Willys Jeeps.
Ah, yes. The iconic Jeeps.
These rugged, compact 4x4 vehicles started making their way down to Colombia, and they were an absolute revelation for the region. The locals literally started calling them mechanical mules.
Because they were structurally perfect for the environment?
Oh, completely perfect.
They had a short wheelbase, high torque, and they were, honestly, virtually indestructible. They were the only machines tough enough to conquer the extreme topography of the Andes.
I mean, they could handle the impossible inclines, the rutted out dirt roads, and the deep mud that swallowed literally everything else.
Everything else just got stuck.
Right. You know, I picture these Willys Jeeps as the blood cells of the entire region.
The blood cells. Oh, I see what you mean.
Yeah, they were constantly circulating the vital nutrients, the coffee, the crops, the supplies, pumping it through these steep, treacherous mountain arteries and delivering it all directly to the heart of the town.
And the physical heart of the town is the plaza, sitting right at the foot of the basilica.
So the reality of a harvest day involves these roaring, mud-caked, exhaust-spewing military jeeps rolling right up to the front steps of this sacred neo-Gothic structure.
And just unloading heavy, dirty sacks of coffee by the dozen.
Exactly.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, you might look at that chaotic scene from an outsider's perspective or a traditional European perspective and think it is a massive profanation of a sacred space.
Just mud, noise, and aggressive commerce literally spilling into the house of the divine.
Right. It feels like breaking a massive rule of architecture.
But for Sevilla, it wasn't a profanation at all.
Not even slightly. The basilica acted as the economic metronome of the town.
The economic metronome. That's a great way to put it.
It didn't just toll the bells for Sunday Mass. The space around it dictated the rhythm of the entire regional economy. Religion didn't stay locked up in the dark behind heavy wooden doors.
No, it walked out into the sunlight among the coffee sacks.
Exactly. The spiritual faith of the people and their grueling agricultural labor were fused into one indissoluble identity.
You literally couldn't separate the sacred from the soil if you tried.
No, you really couldn't.
So we have this fleet of jeeps constantly dumping the region's wealth at the church doors. But a physical space that holds a town's wealth inevitably starts holding its people, too.
It stops being just a loading dock and evolves into a cultural stage.
Because when a space serves as the absolute center of survival and commerce, it naturally becomes the center of life and celebration.
Which takes us right back to Jairo Duke's personal notes on painting the watercolor.
Right. He made a very honest admission about his process there, didn't he?
He did. He said his greatest struggle with this 15x11-inch piece wasn't the technical execution at all.
It wasn't figuring out the geometric perspective of the spire.
No. Or mixing the precise ratio of pigments to match that warm yellow brick. Those are just drafting problems, you know.
Right, an experienced artist can solve those with a ruler and a color wheel.
Exactly. His true struggle was capturing the invisible human pulse, the vibrant, vibrating atmosphere of the town.
Because this plaza eventually transcended just buying and selling coffee, it became the site of massive cultural outpourings.
A perfect example detailed in our sources is the Bandola Festival.
Yes. the Bandola Festival. Instead of that sepulchral pin-drop silence you naturally expect when standing outside a cathedral, this space absolutely explodes with sound.
It's just wild. The festival brings thousands of people into the plaza to celebrate traditional Andean string music.
And the instruments they play are incredibly distinct, too.
Very unique to the region.
You have guitars, of course, but you also have tipples, these beautiful traditional stringed instruments that have 12 strings grouped in fours. They produce this massive, bright, ringing sound.
Oh, it's like a chorus.
Exactly. And you have the bandolas, which are these small teardrop-shaped instruments played with rapid, continuous strumming.
So it is just days of singing, dancing, and celebrating deep heritage all happening right in the shadow of the basilica.
It's a complete sensory overload in the best possible way. The energy is just palpable.
It really is.
I imagine the basilica itself acting as this giant acoustic and emotional resonance chamber. The bright, sharp sound of the bandolas literally bouncing off those warm yellow bricks, amplifying the town's joy.
That's a beautiful image.
But wait, I'm hung up on this idea of the building as the center of the festival. If all this amazing culture is happening in the street, is the building just a pretty backdrop? Does the architecture itself actually matter to the memory of the festival?
This raises an important question about how we view urban spaces. It is incredibly tempting to view historical buildings as just like a stage set.
Yeah, just a nice visual to have in the background of a photograph. Like, if you replace the basilica with a plain brick wall or a modern parking garage, wouldn't the festival be exactly the same?
Well, no, because the architecture here is far more than a backdrop. It is the literal anchor for the collective memory.
I'm trying to visualize this. A building is just brick and mortar. Are you saying the actual physical layout of the church prevented the town's culture from just, I don't know, dissolving?
I'm saying it acts as an emotional sponge. Without that specific, imposing, yet welcoming gravitational center, the trade, the music, the celebrations, and the people themselves would have simply dispersed across the mountains.
Oh, I see.
The plaza exists specifically because the basilica exists. It created the gathering point. And over the decades, the physical material of the building absorbs the life that happens around it.
So it physically records the history.
Exactly. Look at the wear on the stone steps. That isn't just erosion. It's the physical evidence of thousands of muddy boots and Willie's Jeep tires over decades.
Wow.
Look at the layers of paint applied over the years, or the fading of those warm yellows in the intense Andean sun. The building holds the physical evolution of the community.
It doesn't just watch history happen from a distance. It literally stores it in its walls.
It does.
That is such a profound way to look at a structure. And, you know, it takes us right back to the beginning of our deep dive.
Full circle.
Right. We started by looking at a single piece of 300-gram watercolor paper. And through the way Gyro Duke allowed those granulating colors to bleed and mix in the microscopic valleys of the paper, we uncovered a universal truth about religious architecture.
That it isn't just about static bricks or intimidating vertical spires or enforcing a demanding silence.
Exactly. From the rugged texture of the arch's paper capturing unpredictable washes of color to the incredibly rugged Andean mountains traversed by indestructible Willie's Jeeps, these buildings are living archives.
They really are. They were domesticated by the communities that built them, funded by the coffee they grew, and sustained by the music they play.
It creates a landscape that is deeply, fundamentally human, rather than just purely architectural.
And this brings us to a challenge for you listening to this right now. We want you to step outside today and look differently at your own local environments.
Because this phenomenon isn't just isolated to a specific coffee town in the Colombian Andes. Every city, every town has these anchors.
Absolutely everywhere.
Think about an old transit hub in your city, or a century-old open-air market that somehow survived decades of gentrification.
Or maybe it's just a historic church on your block that now simply acts as a backdrop for a really busy bus stop.
Right. Look closely at the worn steps. Look at the chipped, faded layers of paint on the doors. Recognize those details not just as outdated, decaying infrastructure, but as physical records of your neighborhood's daily life.
They are the tangible evidence of everyone who has ever walked through, traded in, or celebrated in that space.
Which leaves us with one final, lingering thought to explore on your own. We've spent this deep dive talking about how architecture acts as an emotional sponge.
Storing all those memories.
Right. If our historic buildings are essentially porous hard drives, literally storing the physical vibrations of past eras, absorbing the rumble of a Willie's Jeep or the ringing strum of a festival bandola, What happens to a community's identity when those spaces are casually demolished?
What happens when they are knocked down and replaced by sterile, soundproof glass towers that reflect everything but absorb absolutely nothing?
When that Wrecker's ball hits, do we merely lose a piece of outdated infrastructure, or do we accidentally format the hard drive of our own cultural memory? Something to think about the next time you walk past that old building on your corner. Thanks for diving deep with us.